Tim Watkins on the panel today from the Pundit blog, and Tim's the producer of the forthcoming show, The Vote, on TV3. Steve McCabe is with us in Auckland too, physicist, reviewer and teacher. Good afternoon, Steve. Good afternoon, Tim.
Afternoon.
Physicist always sounds good, doesn't it? They must be.
It does sound nice. I think I'll throw in nuclear next time.
Yeah.
I like Time Lord personally. But
you've been on your own, actually. You've had your own time, haven't you, recently? Your wife and...
Oh, yeah. Wife and daughter. Being American, they did their annual trip back to the US for 3 weeks. Left me on my own. It was lonely. It was sad. Aww. I mean, it sounds great to be in the exit. I've got the house to myself.
I'm just thinking, just glory.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no nagging, no mithering, no thing. Except there's a list of chores to do that's about 6 pages long. And you think, okay, fine, I'll get around to them. You get up and you think, okay, I can do it all. Watch what I want on telly. Have the music playing as loud as I like. After a few days, and you start to think, okay, well, what's for dinner tonight? And you think, right, you open the fridge.
Fast food again.
Well, no, you can't even be bothered to go out. What's the first 4 things I see in the fridge? You reach in, you think, an hour later, you think, okay, how good an idea is a fish finger burrito, really? And that's what you end up reduced to. And after about 3 weeks, you're going, now when are they coming back?
So by the time they arrive back, you're gibbering with gratitude.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Just so you can be fed and watered and looked after, is what you say.
I'm a boy, obviously. I'm incapable of doing these things for myself. So it's terrible, really. And, I mean, to begin with, I had a week of school holidays, and that was actually quite nice. You get up in the morning, you think, I've got the day stretching out ahead of me, I can do this, I can do that, it's going to be fantastic. School rolls back in again, and suddenly you get up in the morning, the house is empty, and you sit there and eat breakfast alone. You go out to work, you spend a day at work, you come back, empty house, there's nobody there, it just feels lonely. But, I mean, to be fair, it was that or go back and spend 3 weeks staying with my mother-in-law. And I think to be
On balance,
I think I would rather disembowel myself with a dirty meat hook.
There is a website, and they can listen to these things in America. Just saying.
Yeah, but
we're going to send them the link.
Fine, fair enough. I'll just simply remind you of the fact that the mother-in-law is in fact an anagram of woman Hitler.
And
it fits.
The sad and solitary life. And slanderous of Steve McCabe.
It's only slanderous if it's
not
true.
Can I distance myself entirely from this reflection in terms of my mother-in-law, my wife?
Yes, I'm glad I never heard that.
I love my wife and daughter dearly.
I'm glad I never heard any of that. Now, Tim Watkin, tell us about The Vote on TV3.
Well, it's all very exciting. We can start revealing. It starts in March. It is the sister program to Third Degree, which is their 60 Minutes replacement, all local current affairs stories, where once a month. And it is an old-fashioned town hall Barney. It is pick a topic, whatever the big issue of the moment is, and we get teams who can make the best possible case for both sides, debate with a passion, and they're in two teams. One is led by Guy Nespina, the other team is led by Duncan Garner, mm-hmm. And they lead a debate on the topic.
Okay. Are there politicians involved?
The team people who are making this case could be politicians, they could be business leaders, they could be community leaders, they could be people with skin in the game, as you say. It's people who can come on and make a really good case.
But not the usual commentators, as it were.
No, look, it's an open book. It really is if you can argue a case with a passion. We want people to be able to learn something and to get involved. The idea is this national conversation. I mean, it's what I'm calling competitive current affairs because, there will be a winner and a loser at the end of the night because the point of the name, The Vote, is that everybody at home can sit on their... with their texts, with their Twitter, with their Facebook, and with the website, and vote for the motion and
okay.
The motion of the night. Should the price of fish in China is too high? Yes or no, I agree or I don't. The teams will debate yes or no in favour of that motion, and you will vote in favour or against that motion.
Okay.
And we'll have a winner.
But not show business. I mean, well, it's got that element, but serious topics.
Serious topics. Look, it's prime time telly, so there's got to be a bit of a you got to enjoy it. It's not there to send you to sleep, but it's a serious topic. It's proper current affairs in prime time.
Okay.
Amen to that.
That's something new for you to do, to get your teeth into.
Good fun.
All right, Tim Watkin, Steve McCabe. So when's the first one on?
Late March,
thank you. First of all, charter schools. The Chief Ombudsman has objected to attempts by the government to avoid public scrutiny of charter schools. Dame Beverly Wakeham appeared before the Education and Science Select Committee for its first hearing on the Education Amendment Bill, which will introduce publicly funded private schools, and these publicly funded private schools, and the government wants to exclude them from the Official Information and Ombudsman Acts. But Dame Beverly says it's vital to have an independent review mechanism in place, and she says there's no difference between reviewing public or charter schools. Phil Harding joining us shortly. Would you think it's at least advisable for information regarding charter schools to be discoverable by the Ombudsman and under the official information?
Well, there? I'm a journalist, so it's not even a question. Of course it has to be. Where public money is spent, public accountability must follow. Simple as that.
Does anyone understand why the government won't allow these instruments of democracy to apply in this case?
Well, they've railroaded this plan in. There was no talk of this before the election. It suddenly reared its ugly head once this current government was in power. And suddenly said, right, this is what you're having. There's been no discussion, no meaningful discussion about it. And we're now being told this will now be kept in secret with no review. What are they trying to hide? Why is this entire thing being done by stealth?
Well, phrases akin to commercial sensitivity are being invoked, aren't they? Can you immediately...
This is exactly where, and this is the problem. This is the sticky grey patch you get into when you start blurring public and private. The private sector wants profits and it wants confidentiality and those things, and quite properly for how they do the business. But if the public is involved and it's public money being spent and it's, you know, public children being taught, yeah, as it were, then we actually demand better than that. We demand transparency. New Zealand is ranked first in the world for transparency.
And that has to be the price that you pay as a commercial venture.
That's
when
right.
You start taking the public funds. You know, you can't expect to have it both ways. The other question that's not been answered here in terms of accountability is ERO. Will ERO be coming into these schools the same way they come into my school and every other school in the country and holding them to the same standards?
Actually, Phil Harding might know. Phil, of course, is the president of the Principals Federation, joining us now. Hello, Phil.
Good afternoon, Jim.
Nice.
I'm very stressed. I'm very stressed. I've been running around looking for a room to come and talk to you, but I've found one.
Is your school... okay. So, is all the rooms busy still? It's 4:15.
Yep. No. I've found somewhere quiet.
Oh, good. first of all, the matter of the... seeing as Steve McCabe's just raised it, the ERO coming into...
We don't know. And that's just been a big, vague, unanswered question.
Okay. So, don't know that one yet. This, you would think, I'm assuming you'll think this is a legitimate issue that Dame Beverley has raised.
We were thrilled to hear her raise it because she had so much credibility in such an important position, and she's raised the very concerns that we included in our submission about the transparency and the accountability. Why is it such a secret? And how does this create any sort of sense of apples being compared with apples when it comes to evaluating charter schools down the track?
What do you think the government's doing?
I don't know. I think they're driving an ideological idea that was brought in over a cup of tea and giving it wings, and I just don't understand it. But I'm an idealist. What would I know?
But do you have suspicions that, the government's trying to avoid too much early investigation into the way that they start running? What you must have, this is the sort of thing you must discuss among your members.
Well, we do, and we know that all the evidence from overseas about charter schools is that they simply don't work to raise achievement, and yet that's their purported goal. And so, again, it's just baffling that people would turn their back on evidence-based practice and go out on a limb with something that has proven not to work overseas. But charter schools in the UK, there's a set of charter schools called Knowledge is Power, KIP, and the people in the know over in New York refer to these as kids in prison, because they've become little sweatshops for children who are pushed to meet the targets that the charter schools have got to meet to fulfil the objectives of their charter.
It's not just charter schools, you know, for the children of the middle and upper class who can be, you know, coached intensively with, you know, stunning results. I mean, people like John Tamahedi are in favour as an alternative for low decile children, and they are, I think we may have discussed this with you before, they're still awaiting results, aren't they, out of Newark, which is one of America's grimmer cities, to see how the charter schools go among the poor populations of America. So the jury isn't completely in, is it?
There's a lovely little YouTube clip of the selection process for American charter schools, and you see these little faces going off to a basketball stadium and sitting there hoping that they get lucky enough to find a place in the charter school. The hype and the expectation that's built around them is totally at odds to the experience that these kids get when they rock on in as little pupils.
Well, we're going to have them, and we've talked about the merits of charter schools before, so I guess what we're really talking about today is the merits of scrutiny. So what happens here, do you think, Phil Harding?
Well, I've been trying to work that out. The select committee process has started and they're listening to submissions, and we delivered our submission yesterday. And I've been asking people, does this mean we're going to get changes made? Do you think they'll listen to what we've been saying, or is this a done deal? And, you know, this nature of politics is becoming clear to me that they are going to drive charter schools in. But I think with Dame Beverly Wakeham raising the concerns that she's raised, we've all got to be sitting there saying, is this good enough for New Zealand? And as one of your panellists just said, you know, what's happened to our great reputation for transparency? We are very concerned.
Okay. Another topic, Phil. Stephen Joyce says he's authorised the Ministry of Education to send formal breach of contract notices to Talent 2, the Australian company that created and runs NovaPay. On the other hand, he's revealed that the government set aside $5 million, according to the National Business Review, to patch up NovaPay, which indicates to some that there are no immediate plans to break with Talent 2. Weren't we waiting for a big technical review before deciding whether we'd persevere with NovaPay, or is it just a $5 million set aside to cover all contingencies? What's your understanding?
Well, I don't know, because I haven't discussed this with Minister Joyce. I'm hoping that what it means is that he recognises whether it's Talent 2 that gets the nod with its NovaPay software or whether it's Plan B, payroll's going to need a significant injection of cash while we sort it out. And the sad reality that schools have got to get their heads around is that this is not going to end when the technical review's finished, and it's not going to end when the ministerial inquiry is completed. It's just going to go on and on and on. And I can tell you the principals that are contacting our national office are they're close to having a complete meltdown, a complete breakdown, this huge anger building, because we've asked the ministry to acknowledge the efforts of those schools to prop the system up, and we haven't had that yet. And we desperately need a little crumb that says we get the anguish and here's some compensation to schools.
Okay. An emailer, people email about this, about the why of NovaPay. And John says, and Phil, I wonder if you could comment on this. I can't help thinking that the pay model in education with 12 pay steps and allowances for Africa is a big contributing factor that would never have occurred in the private sector, but I've never heard it discussed in the current debate. And someone who was involved in the NovaPay system as a subcontractor echoes that, saying the number of variables, you know, teacher gets X dollars a week, 10-year-long service dollars, also the part-time caretaker, was the deputy principal for 3 weeks, paying off a student loan, etc. The sheer complexities of being employed as a teacher sometimes is, in fact, at the root cause of the NovaPay troubles. Is that your understanding at all?
Look, wasn't it ever so? People went into this with their eyes wide open and a set of contracts that haven't changed over the life of NovaPay particularly. So I would have thought that the software gurus and wizards and the ministry staff and all the planners and schemers and developers understood what they were letting themselves in for. Yes, we've got a complicated payroll and we've got 100,000 people. I don't know about those tricky things, but I don't think the ground rules haven't changed halfway through.
Okay, but you suspect that they should have trialled it thoroughly, knowing the complexities going in. That was the principle.
Isn't hindsight a great thing? I think everybody from the Talent 2 and the ministry down would say, oh, wouldn't a trial have been a gorgeous thing? Because this is a nightmare.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Phil Harding on the panel at 21 minutes past four. Were you going to say something about teachers' pay, were you?
About NovaPay, where do you start? It's not a disgrace. We've got an absolutely ridiculous system here where schools, boards of trustees, are the employers of their teachers, and yet the responsibility for paying is then tendered out to, for example, at the moment, Talent 2 through NovaPay to pay on their behalf. But it's the employers who are responsible for paying. So last week I got an email from my school telling me that I would be underpaid this time round. And I'm thinking, in any other business, if an employer simply writes to an employee and says, oh, by the way, we won't be paying you your full salary this time round, deal with it. You'd be looking at lawsuits. It's absolute disgrace. Employers aren't allowed to do that, but my employer did. Now, my employer was put in the position of having to do that by Talent 2 or the ministry. You can decide which. And they've actually tried to do the right thing by me by offering to give me a sub. And it was $250. I'm fortunate enough that $250 being paid a fortnight late isn't going to break me. But I know people who are missing entire paychecks And that is compromising them. Mm. And it's terrible that we're being put in this position. For subcontractors from Novapay to say, oh dear, we didn't quite realise what the job was, isn't it tricky? That's disingenuous. They signed up for this job, they've taken it on, and presumably they've taken the money for it, so now they have to deliver a working product. For the ministry to say they're looking for a some sort of breach of contract settlement, presumably looking at compensation from Talent 2, I can't wait to see how much of that trickles down to the poor sods at the bottom of the dump who actually are the ones who aren't getting paid. That would be me and my colleagues. Are we going to see anything from our employers who've defaulted on our salaries?
Sarah, a texter echoing Phil Harding, actually says the old pay provider managed the complexities of paying teachers.
Yes.
And may get the chance to do so again.
Yeah, why are we still even going on with Novapay? Apparently, according to Mr. Joyce, it is clear that any alternative to Novapay will be challenging. Fine, deal with the challenge. That's not my problem. My problem is I'm not getting paid.
Yeah, but the reality is you've got a dog now, which you've got to fix, or you can bring a new dog in, which is going to take you maybe up to a year. Now, can you fix the dog in less than a year, or do you bring in the new dog in a year? If you want the problem fixed, one or the other, as quickly as possible, that's why you spend, to be fair to Joyce, that's why you spend $5 million now to try and fix the dog you're doing while you're talking to other people to see how quickly you can get it in. That seems to make sense to me. He's keeping his options open. He's going down two tracks and try and get the right system in place as quickly as possible.
And the reality is, if any employee behaved like this and said, look, I've been absolutely horrible at my job for 6 months and it was anticipated before you hired me that I would be rubbish for 6 months and it's going to take another year to get me competent at my job, then you'd be looking at firing this individual almost immediately.
Difficult under the current environment.
but the point is, though, that when you've got something like Talent 2, we're getting into the too big to fail argument. Something like that, you say, well, the alternatives are even worse, so we just have to stick with them. And in the meantime, there's thousands and thousands of people who aren't getting paid. And we don't want to hear about, well, it's difficult and it's one dog versus another. Right. We just want to get paid.
Okay. Mm. New Zealanders,
sorry, I'm ranting.
It's all right. New Zealanders need to earn nearly $5 more than the minimum wage to meet the basic necessities of life. According to a new report, which we've already discussed, but it's officially out today, the living wage for New Zealanders has been set at $18.40 an hour. In the report, which is well above the $13.50 minimum wage, defined as the income necessary to provide workers and their families with the basic necessities of life, and the wage will form the basis of a community-driven campaign for employers to adopt a living wage policy. So we've discussed it this week with Charles Waldegrave already. Now his report is officially out and has been circulated. What do you think?
I think this is a coming story that is going to get legs during the year. I think that really, I know people are trying to cobble together arguments against it, but if you can work full time and still not have enough to make ends meet, something is broken and needs to be fixed. It really is as simple as that. President Obama said in a State of the Nation in America yesterday, he said, tonight, let's declare that in the wealthiest nation on earth, no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty. Mm. Surely we should be able to say the same thing in New Zealand, that if you work full-time, you shouldn't suffer poverty. End of. There's no more. There really is no question after that. I don't care if it costs more to the business, then charge more. I will pay that. I do not expect to get my goods and services from someone for less than they can afford to live.
Are you surprised, though, that the measures used to define poverty in New Zealand are still argued about so vociferously, along with the extent to which there is genuine poverty?
No, because there are many indicators. I mean, the 60% of the median wage seems to be the most commonly used one, but there are different measures in different countries, so you are going to have that argument. But the point is that when you look at the kind of numbers that Waldegrave has broken down and see that, you know, this much for rent, this much for food, this much for power and so forth, they are not large numbers. If we can't get those, if an employer cannot give that to someone for a week's work, then they're not doing something.
You talked about the arguments being cobbled together against it. One is on Kiwi Blog today. The reality is, I'm quoting, that economically it's daft to have a minimum wage based on the needs of 850,000 adults yet applying to all 3 million workers. In other words, you are trying to make the livable wage universal, but in fact, it's not needed except by the genuinely poor.
And I think there is a reasonable point that you can adapt that number for different circumstances. Charles Waldegrave said this is for a family of a couple with two children. So let's not try and be cute about it. He's clear for what that number's for. If you're on your own and so forth, I'm sure there could be alterations made around that.
But the principle
is that you've got to be able to make ends meet at the end of the week.
But how then do we means test income? Before you take a job that pays a minimum wage, do you submit to some form of means testing to decide which minimum? Do you get the single man's minimum wage? Do you get the mother of two's minimum wage? How are you going to administer?
Possibly. I mean, we do that. We do benefits that way. So maybe we do wages that way. I'm not in any position to design the detail of that. But I just think the principle is so unavoidable that you just have to find a way.
I absolutely agree with you on that one. I think we can step back and say that any employee in any private company is not simply, say, a ditch digger or a shelf stacker or whatever it might be. That person is somebody who functions within the company to generate wealth for the owners of the company. And what the owners of the company are then saying is that my generation of wealth is not sufficiently valuable that you are worth being paid a living wage. And that's something of an insult to the workers.
Well, a suggestion's been from one listener this afternoon, actually, that, you know, it's the employers who can afford it. But that makes it even more complex still. But there are convincing case examples, as you say, coming into us and emails I've been reading out over the last few days that are genuine deprivation and genuine poverty. But the problem is, for some of the scepticism, is measuring it using a percentage of the mean income. Because they aren't case examples. They aren't examples. I mean, you could probably make a case for... people have been making cases, you know, for using that system, that a family could have $800 coming in a week. And sure, that's inconvenient. Sure, that's hard. But is it genuine poverty?
Well, but I guess I come at it from the point that we're talking about trying to create a system in a human state. It's not going to be perfect. Some people are going to be on the wrong side of the line. But we do that with traffic laws. We do it with our welfare state. We create lines artificially for this. A wage should be no different. We are a terribly, terribly low-wage economy. It is quite, as arguably the most important problem our politicians could actually address now is trying to get New Zealand wages higher so that we can actually then deal with things like housing and so forth.
Okay, so you're saying the essential truth of the matter is out there.
Absolutely, and we're going to get an imperfect system one way or the other. Yes, there's going to be holes in it, but if we cannot get a system where people can earn a working wage and actually live well, then we're doing something wrong because we are a rich country.
And where's the incentive, frankly, for getting a job when you're only going to be working poor anyway?
Yeah.
If we're trying to get people off benefits and get them into work, make work more attractive.
NovaPay solution from Paul Hur of Southland. Fire all the teachers, then rehire them all on a simple salary plan. You need to read I've Been Thinking by Richard Preble. Just a quick comment from you, seeing as you are a teacher, although you're not a spokesperson for the teachers or the principals or anything. But would it be so? I mean, do teachers talk about this? Would it be simple? Is there a simpler way of paying teachers so you don't have, you know?
It's not as complicated as they're trying to make it out to be. I get a very, very simple salary. I'm on step 12 in the salary scale. I get this much money every year. That's it. There's nothing clever about it. There's nothing tricky. The only what went wrong with my salary last time was I took a week of unpaid leave back last June to go back to England for my parents' 50th wedding anniversary. We then get holiday pay toward the end of the year based on our service during the year, and NovoPay couldn't handle that. This is not terribly complicated. It's not rocket surgery.
Millions of corporates around the world must handle that all the time.
Exactly, yeah. It's not rocket science. I know this because I teach rocket science. I know it's not that hard, and yet they couldn't manage that.
So touché, sir.
Once again, if in doubt, blame the teachers.
Steve McCabe, Tim Watkin, back with them shortly. Mike standing by with the news headlines.